From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Asbrook, and this is On Point. Ellen McCarthy was named wedding reporter for The Washington Post the same day she broke up with her longtime boyfriend. And of course, she was 30. For the next 4 years, she went to wedding after wedding, talking with all the couples, with the people who think about couples and love and marriage and what works and what doesn't. And yes, she found new love and she got married. This hour on Point, what works in love and marriage? Later in this hour, we will look at the late, great B.B. King, who passed yesterday in Las Vegas at 89. But first, to marriage, sometimes it goes just right, and sometimes, even at the wedding, well, it may not. People mess up their vows. Here, Andrew and Melissa, wonderful, off YouTube.
I, Andrew Paul Daniel Engstrom.
Do take Melissa Renee Warren.
Do take Melissa Renee Warren.
To be my lawfully wedded wife.
To be my lawfully and pancakey.
my waffly wedded wife. Well, maybe an awkward start is a good way to begin. Joining us from Washington now is Ellen McCarthy, author of the new book, The Real Thing, Lessons on Love and Life from a Wedding Reporter's Notebook. You can read an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. Ellen McCarthy, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me.
So do you really learn what works and what doesn't from covering all those crazy weddings out there?
I did. As you mentioned at the top of the hour, I came to this position at a sort of precarious moment in my own life, having gone through a breakup within hours of finding out that I was, going to take on this new beat. And it was
That's just nuts. We fear that you planned that all the way all those years ago because it made such a great hook for writing a book about it.
Yeah. No, I honestly felt like I was trapped in a bad chick flick, a very cliche film.
I'm 30. I lost my boyfriend and I'm covering weddings every Saturday night.
And I really did feel like a cliche. I was spending all this time interviewing these blissfully happy couples and then, rushing off to cry in the bathroom. It was such an odd, surreal time. And I didn't know what the impact was going to be on me psychologically of sort of spending my time with all these happy couples while I was sort of fearful that that would never happen to me. But what actually did happen was that, A, it made me more optimistic about finding love, and B, it really changed my perspective and my approach to relationships. I felt like I was learning all of these incredible lessons from these couples that I was interviewing, some of whom were just about to walk down the aisle, many of whom had been married for years and years and years. And along the way, I just gathered all of these incredible pearls of wisdom. And I ultimately think it really did help me find the right one for me. And I felt a real obligation to pass this incredible gift along to a broader audience. And so that's why I ended up writing what basically amounts to a field guide to relationships, because that's what I was given through this job.
Yes, just about here. It's a funny book. It's chipper and generous in its spirit, I would say. You covered weddings for 4 years, not 40, so you didn't really get to see which of these marriages would last and which did not. When you sat down at a new wedding on a new Saturday night and looked at a couple, did you have a feeling in your gut each time, oh, this looks like a promising coupling, or this doesn't?
Yes, I did. I would often meet with the couples and interview them for a couple of hours, usually in the week or two before a wedding. And, sometimes I would think, oh my gosh, you guys, it's only Wednesday. The wedding's not scheduled till Saturday. We can call this off. I'll start calling the guests for you.
What would make you get that feeling, the hairs on the back of your neck going up, no, don't do this?
Okay, if you can't answer the question, what do you love most about this person, without saying, that's a really hard one.
Oh,
if you fall asleep in the middle of an interview about your own relationship, that's a bad sign.
Yeah.
If you bicker the entire way through while sitting at opposite ends of the couch, it made my job difficult.
On the other hand, does mooning and swooning mean it's all going to work out?
No, of course not. Of course not. The couples girls that I loved the most and that I respected the most were really clear-eyed about each other and about their relationship. And they had really reasonable expectations for what was going to make their marriage work. You know, they weren't expecting it to be all butterflies and roses. And that certainly is one of my favorite lessons in the book that I learned from a lot of couples who'd been together for years, is that, you know, you sort of need to manage your expectations. If you think that it's going to be a honeymoon forever, then you really are setting yourself up for disappointment. And ultimately, you're not giving the relationship a fair chance. You know, you need to go into it with open eyes, knowing that there could be and will be tough spots along the road, but that's par for the course. And I think that's a message that maybe we don't send enough in society.
Did a big, great wedding make any difference? I mean, after all, you were the wedding reporter here. Whether you sort of begin it with a bang or with something modest in the backyard, is that a tell?
No, of course not. You know, I think, there's been a lot of discussion about the huge wedding industrial complex, and I don't think it's going away. And I think that it puts enormous amount of pressure on couples. And, you know, one of the things I always say is that in my 4 years of covering weddings, the people who got married by the bank of a river when it was, you know, a freezing cold morning and it was just the officiant and the couple and me are just as married as the couples who had 400 people and spent $100,000, you know, tying the knot. They're just as married at the end of the day. And in some ways, I had a lot of respect for those couples because they weren't in this to throw a big party. They were in it to get married.
You talked with a lot of couples. You also talked with a lot of people who think about relationships and love and marriage. Did the couples who were embarking and those who make careers of thinking about what works and it doesn't, did they have similar views?
Sometimes. I mean, I think that's one of the reasons that I wrote this book, was that I felt like there was this really huge wealth of information out there because there are so many people in academia and in the social sciences who are really studying and finding out what it is that makes love work and that can make a marriage last. And I didn't feel like that information was getting through to the general public. You know, it was sort of being stored behind our ivy walls. And I felt the need to sort of be a bridge there and to get some of that information out there, because I didn't always feel like couples, and I didn't feel like I, before I embarked on this journey, had that kind of information in my toolkit. And it's so useful.
We've got all kinds of people responding to you here. Amy says, my wedding was great. I called the Justice of the Peace on Monday. We got married on Friday afternoon in my parents' backyard. We wore jeans. My mom got a cake from the grocery store. Just our immediate families there. Truly spectacular. Two people in our 20s saw no reason to spend a bunch of money. Now, she says, we're celebrating 21 years in November, along with five gorgeous kids. They didn't have to have Westminster Cathedral to make that work out, it sounds like.
So wise. It's so wise. You know, listen, and my cynicism pendulum has swung back and forth on weddings. I came into the job, frankly, I didn't say this when I applied for the job, but I was pretty cynical about weddings. You know, I just thought that there's just so much stuff, and I was never into the sort of, you know, what color theme should you choose part of weddings. Now, having gone to them every Saturday night for 4 years, I really came to love them. And I love this miracle that happens when two people stand before each other and really pledge to join their lives. You know, I was always touched by that, whether it happened in a courthouse or, you know, some kind of giant venue, something really did happen. And so I'm not anti-wedding. I'm very pro-wedding, but I'm just pro doing it in a way that really works for the two of you and isn't about kowtowing to societal expectations.
I love these stories coming in. Of course, we're heading into wedding season right now in June. Lots of weddings. But Laura writes to us, this couldn't have been June. She says, my own wedding, cowboy headed justice of the peace charged us $20 to perform a civil ceremony on the steps of the Grimes County Courthouse in Anderson, Texas. It was 16 degrees. We opted for the shortest ceremony he could perform. 90 seconds later, we were married. We tipped him $25 for coming out in the cold. 25 years and still perfect for each other. Jennifer's calling from Andover, Massachusetts. Jennifer, thanks for calling. You're on the air with Ellen McCarthy.
Thank you for taking my call, Tom.
What do you know?
I Well, I was going to tell you that I actually do hair and makeup for weddings, and I've been in the business for about 15 years, and I couldn't agree more with Ellen. You know when a marriage is going to last just by meeting the bride and the way she talks about her husband. I'm not always in the same room with brides and their fiancés, but, you know, I've had girls who you knew they were going to be amazing just by the way they were describing each other, the way she was describing him.
What about it? What's the tell? What lets you know in her description of him, let's say?
I feel like you get the feeling that they're friends, that they make each other laugh, that they, you know, they have something. And they don't have to have been together for a long time either. You can really feel when they like each other as people and that they're in love, too. But I've also been on the other end of the spectrum where I've had girls who've had to take as many painkillers as possible before the wedding and cocktails. And you know this girl's doing the wrong thing, but she's on a train that's left the station and it's just gone. And you can just feel that. That's got an egg timer on it. It's not going to last.
Too many cocktails and pills, and the train has left the station. That does not sound good. Jennifer, I appreciate your call. Ellen, we just got a half a minute before the break, but you say watch out for fear. People get locked in fear and in that go forward even when they shouldn't.
Yeah. Oh, and she's right. The train leaves the station. The vendors have been paid, and it's very hard to call it off. But I have had close people in my own life and couples I've written about who called off their weddings, and I couldn't respect them more. It's a hard thing to do, but if it's the right thing, it's just really the most honorable way to go.
Oh, there's Frank Sinatra at the door. Who knew? Ellen McCarthy's new book is The Real Thing, Lessons on Love and Life from a Wedding Reporter's Notebook. Ellen, stand by. In Washington, listeners, you can join us. What does it take these days to make a good match, to find the right partner, to make it last? Have you got a good thing going? What makes it work? Share your secret. And is marriage still the point for you, the goal? 800-423-8255 is our number. 800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
To this conclusion, love and marriage, love and marriage, go together like a horse and carriage. Dad was told by mother, you can't have one, you can't have none, you can't have one without the other.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about love and marriage and what makes them work these days. With Ellen McCarthy, she was wedding reporter for the Washington Post. The same day she was named wedding reporter, she broke up with her boyfriend. She was 30 years old. She thought a lot about these issues over the next 4 years, going almost every Saturday night to a wedding. Now she's married, and what, you've got a kid as well, Ellen, so you're well into this, right?
Yep, and one on the way next month, so
hey,
we're busy.
Hey, now that paints yet another picture. Her new book is The Real Thing, Lessons on Love and Life from a Wedding Reporter's Notebook, and it's all about what she saw at the altar and beyond in dating, in weddings, in relationships over time, and what makes them work. Are you about to walk down the aisle? Tell us why. Make the case for your decision. We'll be the judges right here. Here's when we pulled off YouTube. This Rob and Megan, here's part of Megan's vows. September, just last year.
In you, I have found my truest and closest friend. You are my greatest achievement, my most prized possession, and my ultimate soulmate. From so early on, you became such a huge part of my life, my dreams, my future, and my family. The love that we share cannot possibly be defined by the words that we say today or ever. Let our love be defined by the time that I have spent by your side, the side-splitting laughs that we've shared on a daily basis, and the way that we selflessly, authentically, and passionately love one another.
Who can argue with any of that? Hit YouTube, and there they all are. Some will last. Some will not. Ellen McCarthy is with us from Washington. Ellen, I want to welcome an old friend into our conversation as well, if I may. Stephanie Kuntz joins us from Olympia, Washington, in Washington State, professor of history and family studies at the Evergreen State College, co-chair, director of research at the Council on Contemporary Families at the University of Miami, and author of Marriage, a History. Stephanie Kuntz, welcome back to On Point.
Thanks. It's great to talk to you again.
What do you think of this project of Ellen, the wedding reporter, setting out to tell us what works and what doesn't when it comes to love?
Well, I think it's a lot of fun. I think you have to be a little careful. I don't want to be a killjoy because it really is hard to predict how things fall out in the future. But a couple of things I think were very sensible. One of the things that your caller said about being friends, I think this is so much more important than it used to be. I mean, I've studied marriages through the history, and, you know, back in the 40s and 50s, you could basically marry a gender stereotype and have a good marriage. You know, and people would say things to you like, and these marriages would last and consider themselves happy. Well, my husband, he doesn't understand the kids very well, or he doesn't understand my moods, but he's such a good provider. And the man would say, well, I can't talk to her about my work, but she's such a good mom and she's such a wonderful wife. And that doesn't cut it anymore. I think this notion of friendship is extremely important, extremely deep. And you can have love without friendship. You can have love without respect. And people can think that they're soulmates and yet not have that respect and love. So I think that's very important. So there's lots of many ways. I mean, I agree that certainly an expensive big wedding and is not a good entree. Or it's, I think there's this magical thinking that some people do that, oh, okay, if we have the unique wedding and spend all this money making it very special, that it will do something. And in fact, some research suggests that the more expensive weddings are actually less likely to last. I would take that with a grain of salt myself. But I do think that it's important to understand that a marriage is about more than just a relationship between two people. So however you do it, welcoming your friends and your family mm-hmm. to take an interest in the relationship. And at least in my marriage, we also promised our friends and family that we wanted them to support our relationship, but that we wouldn't sacrifice our previous relationship with them to just the couple relationship. And for me, that's been a very important part of my marriage.
Ellen McCarthy, we're getting response here from listeners that seems to go right along the line of some of your key observations here. I mean, one of the things that you write in The Real Thing, you say, that as your reporting continued over the years, you write, I became increasingly convinced of one thing. We ask a lot more from relationships than we're willing to put into them. You know, we put all this work into our diet and everything about life, but you say, except love. We continue to treat love like magic fairy dust that should appear mysteriously, anoint us in rapture, and relieve all our late-night Ben and Jerry's binge-eating sorrow. Christopher writes to us on Twitter. He says, IMHO, in my humble opinion, the secret, quote-unquote, is to accept that love is a verb requiring action and effort, not simply an emotion.
Yeah. Of course it is. I really agree. And I have to say, I agree with Stephanie, too, and her point about, you know, our expectations again. One of my favorite couples in the book is this couple, Betty and Edgar. And they had been together for 65 years by the time I met with them. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I knocked on the door and they opened it up and they were both about 3 feet tall. And they just looked up at me and toddled back into their back room with their matching canes. And I, you know, spent a couple of hours trying to figure out what's the secret to a happy marriage. And we talked and talked. And then finally I turned off my tape recorder and I, you know, I had by then fallen in love with this couple. They had kind of a Woody Allen-esque rapport and they just laughed at each other's jokes and they were so charming and wonderful. And to me, it was so evident that they were just meant to be together. And I said, you know, in my generation, we spend a lot of time thinking about and looking for and searching for the one, our soulmate. Mm-hmm. What do you think about that idea? And Tom, Betty looked at me like she was really going to slap me. I thought she might just reach over.
I'm confused.
She said, you people, what are you doing today? You know, she said, if I hadn't been with Edgar for 65 years, I would have been with somebody else for 65 years. To her, it wasn't about finding some perfect person with whom everything was just going to magically work out. It was about making a commitment and sticking with it.
I don't know. Maybe I'm old-fashioned romantic. I felt like I found the one. But of course, it takes commitment too. I mean, yeah. Stephanie, you say at one time it was just men. I think I heard you say marry a gender stereotype and stick with it. And that would be this older married woman's generation you're talking about. But what about now, Stephanie?
Well, I think that, of course, there have always been exceptions, people who were able to get these friends. But I do think that, you know, back in the 1950s, the average couple married each other after knowing each other only 6 months. Today, that would not cut it at all. Today, we expect more of marriage. You know, sometimes people say, well, we're not as committed to marriage as couples were of the past. But actually, the fact is we are asking more of marriage than couples did of the past. Well, we want it to be, you know, again, you go back in history, marriage was kind of a deal that you didn't have much option. A woman didn't have much of a life outside it. She expected to marry someone who was older, wiser, smarter, and, of course, could support her.
She needed it financially.
Exactly, and she expected to defer to him, and the man expected, without having to be, you know, a meanie, he just kind of expected that the woman would adjust her life to his. Now we enter marriage at much older ages with equal experience and often equal earnings power. Sometimes the woman's more educated than her husband. That used to be a risk factor for marriage. Now it's not anymore. The thing that really counts in marriage today is the give and take, the equality, the friendship, the sharing. And that is something that we never had to think about before. That's why we have to work at our marriages in ways that couples didn't have to do in the past.
Ellen, you write about the necessity of getting really actively engaged here, ways in which we can actively improve chances of relationship success. Share some of those.
Yeah, I mean, I think the big one is to, as you mentioned before, really change our perspective. You know, my overarching message in this book is that we can learn to be good at love, and that maybe we have to be willing to learn in order to be good at love and in order to increase our chances of having a successful relationship.
But what does that mean?
And I think that means, you know, if you're ready, getting ready to get married, don't just spend all your time preparing for the wedding. You know, take some kind of premarital education course where you're learning communication techniques, you know, talking to people who've been in long marriages, learning from the people who've gone before us, you know, reading books like Stephanie so that you have this perspective on what to expect from marriage. There's a zillion great relationship books out there. And I think that we often think that we have to, you know, kind of hide them beneath our pillows because it would be embarrassing to have to learn about relationships because we think that, gosh, if we met the right person and we're in love, then that's all that there should be to it. And in fact, it's just really not always intuitive. You know, we need to sort of learn how to fight respectfully and in a way that we feel understood and heard by each other. We need to learn how to communicate.
You've got a story in here of a couple, I believe, who whenever they would fight, they would hold hands so the fight
isn't
could only
amazing?
Go so far.
But actually, there are many scientific studies that proven that any kind of physical contact with your partner, you know, it really does work to increase your connection. And it doesn't have to be just sex. You know, these are people who just held hands or maintained eye contact. And there are a zillion little practical things that we can do like that to improve our relationships. One of my favorite couples is a pair named Bob and Henry who met during World War II. And, you know, they'd been together for over 60 years by the time that same-sex marriage became legal in the District of Columbia, and they decided to get married. And I asked them, what's the secret to staying together for this long? And I thought that they would say something about enduring against prejudice or, you know, something, you know, really profound like that. And they said, you have to be polite. You have to say please and thank you and excuse me and touch the small of your partner's back when you pass them in the kitchen. Treat your partner with the same respect you would treat a checkout clerk or a waitress. These are such simple things, but they're things that any of us can do to maintain the health of our relationships.
I always thought in some ways it comes down to a kind of super mutual generosity. If you can be more flexible and giving with your partner than maybe with anybody else, that's a pretty good basis on which to build. Susan in Auburn Hills, Michigan. Susan, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for letting me contribute. I agree totally with all what has been said, and I want to share a little romantic story where my current husband and I had previously been married, and we did the big hoopla wedding. And when it came time for us, and we fell in love, and I believed that I needed to go through a whole year of seasons with a future partner to see how that worked out. And then when it did all work out, he planned a surprise elopement to Sedona, Arizona. And I flew out there unknowing, and it just was a whirlwind type of romance. And he's been romantic ever since with just special little weekends or that mutual giving of himself.
Susan, why do you think it's working out better this time than the first time out for each of you?
I think the first time he married, because that's what his parents wanted to do, it was like a family friend, and I married, I think, because I probably didn't date a lot, and the first one I fell in love with, I said, okay, boom, that's it. And I was younger, I was 23, I think. Yes, we were both older. I was 30, I think, when I got married to Stephen, and he's 3 years younger than me, so... And we've been married 25 years and have three lovely children. We're on our way to one of their graduations. And
that's a great story.
They all know the story and love hearing it. And I still tell the story of the surprise elopement because people can't believe it.
But, Treasure, a surprise elopement, and 25 years later, it's working out just fine. I mean, Ellen, you got so freaked out here after your breakup, just as you took up this wedding reporter role, you went out and had your eggs frozen. You were not confident that you were going to find a guy in time to still be like fertile and ready to do the whole family thing.
Yeah, I mean, it's true. And I was finding myself, you know, waking up in the middle of the night, just, you know, in cold sweats, feeling like not only did I have to find the right guy, but I needed to find him right now. And I think that that's a pressure that a lot of people are familiar with, men and women, frankly. And I needed to do something to release the pressure valve because, frankly, I was worried that I would make a mistake, that I would worry that that fear would cause me to make a bad decision and maybe to, you know, marry the, as the previous caller said, the first guy who comes around.
So,
you know,
eggs just in the freezer gave you a little comfort zone or something.
It did. It just made me a little more sane, Tom, frankly.
Wow.
And it made me enjoy dating a little bit more. And when I did meet the man who became my husband, it was sort of an awkward conversation to have. Hey, I'm going to put my future children on ice. How do you feel about that? But actually, it was really a relief to both of us because then our own relationship could develop, in a natural manner of time and not be pressured by that.
Did you use those eggs, dear Ellen?
I haven't yet.
Okay. Eggs not collected. Rachel in Stillwater, Oklahoma. Rachel, you're on the air.
Hello, Tom.
Hi. What's your story?
I just wanted to call and say this is a wonderful story. And my husband and I will be celebrating our 7th year anniversary next Wednesday.
Congratulations.
He and I got married at 19. And so it was under, like, the secret to our success. When we were younger, our family had a lot of influence, and we really cared about what they thought and the things that they were saying and how they felt about it. And that caused a lot of trouble for us at first, but when we got through kind of the hard time, we had to realize that, you know, it doesn't really matter what anybody else thinks. You know, it's his opinion that's most important to me, and my opinion that's most important to him, and it just functions better that way when it's just two people in a marriage instead of the whole family.
Rachel, I'm right there with you. In the end, you've got to be there for each other, have each other's backs. That's no doubt true. Stephanie, people are getting married later. Is that making a difference in the quality or success of marriages?
Well, I think it does. One Council on Contemporary Families research study found that for every year a woman delays marriage right up until her early 30s, she has less of a chance of divorce. And after that, it levels off, but it doesn't go up again. I think that people are delaying marriage and coming to it with more emotional, economic, and educational resources. And because negotiation is such an important part of marriage nowadays in ways that, again, as I said, it didn't have to be in the past, I think that's a very important thing. And I wanted to say one thing about that is relevant to this, about the question of bickering.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, obviously, if people are picking at each other all the time, it's not good. But one of the things that we found is that couples who bicker in the first 3 years, not roll their eyes contempt, I'm not talking about that, but who bicker, actually report themselves happier after 10 or 15 years.
Because they're engaging? They're figuring each other out?
They're engaging, exactly. That's exactly right. Because not one person is just giving in and taking up with it until they can't put it up anymore. They're bickering because both of them come in, they're older, they have established lives and routines, and they got to work this out. and they're not going to work it out unless they bicker occasionally.
Stephanie Kuhn, stand by there in beautiful Olympia, Washington. It's always great to have you with us. Ellen McCarthy in Washington. She was wedding reporter for the Washington Post. Her new book is The Real Thing, Lessons on Love and Life from a Wedding Reporter's Notebook. You can read an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. And you can join us with your story, 800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. Little Bruno Mars right here. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. Hi, everybody. Tom here. I'm glad you're joining us for this On Point podcast. Before we get back to the show, I'd like to tell you about another podcast you might enjoy, too, Dear Sugar Radio. Join hosts Cheryl Strayed and Steve Almond as they field questions about love, sex, work, guilt, money, you name it. That's Dear Sugar Radio. You can find it at wbur.org/Dear Sugar or subscribe on iTunes. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking about love and marriage and what makes them work these days. With Ellen McCarthy, she was reporter, wedding reporter for the Washington Post. 4 years of watching weddings, talking to people getting married every Saturday night, and a lot more than just them. She's written it all up in a new book, The Real Thing, Lessons on Love and Life from a Wedding Reporter's Notebook. Joins us from Washington. From Olympia, Washington, Stephanie Kuntz is here, professor of history and family studies at the Evergreen State College, author of Marriage, A History, and a lot more. Here's another great one we found off of YouTube. Jeanette and Matt, married last September, decided to write their vows, her vows, Jeanette did anyway, as a slam poetry presentation.
While climbing the attractive Mount Everest of your mind, I attempted to hike a little higher to take a peek at your soul. I lost my footing on that trail, dangled off the cliff of your condition of unconditional, and there is where I fell, in love. Skydiving on the wings of your patience, thank you for catching me, but this love, it's too much. This love is just way too much because your smoldering volcano erupted upon my arrival.
Boom! Jeanette and Matt married there just last September. Love it, dangling off the cliff of your condition. And Ryan in Boston, thanks for calling, Ryan. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Yeah, I'm calling because, you know, I spent the last few years as a wedding DJ, so I was attending, you know, just as many weddings, you know, as your guest.
Great. Wedding DJ, meet wedding reporter. We've got every type of wedding person here. What'd you learn, Ryan?
I think what I learned was to keep things simple as far as the wedding goes and wait until you're ready, because it seemed like folks that, you know, maybe rushed into things, they would be focused on all the specific details of their day, and they weren't really ready for those details to maybe not go exactly as planned. Where when I would, you know, work with couples that were a little bit older, they knew what they wanted. They always seemed to know how to keep things simple and focused on what was important that day. And if maybe something didn't go well, it started raining, you know, if things were running behind schedule, they were the ones that were more laid back about it, because I think they were there because they wanted to be, and not because it was, you know, the next logical step in their life, and they just kind of rushed into it.
So listen, wedding DJ Ryan, did you have a sense of whose wedding marriages would work and whose wouldn't? Did you feel a hunch every time out?
You know what? I never really felt like I should be judging that.
Good DJ.
It was never something I thought too much about. You know, for me, it was more about making sure that, you know, when they ended the day, they really felt good about it. And honestly, yeah, it was a really great job, because people in general, most of the time, you know, everyone is just so happy. It's a pretty good work environment.
Yeah, weddings are pretty fun. The wedding DJ checks in. We appreciate it, Ryan. Let me get one more, if I may. Charlottesville, Virginia. Steve is on the line. Hi, Steve. You're on the air.
Hey, I just had a question. Hi, Tom.
Hi.
And thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
I just had a question about conventional marriage versus modern relationships. I think you guys had a piece on NPR a while ago about relationships lasting for years and the couple never getting married. And I just wanted to know what your guest's comments are on that.
We'll pick it up. Thank you, Steve. Ellen, I guess first to you, did you find people aiming for, you know, despite all the changes in time and cultural shifts, aiming for marriage? Or is that somehow less important? We know people are marrying in smaller numbers or percentages than they used to. What about that issue of how we put relationships together, Ellen?
Yeah, I mean, listen, I think that there's a reason that there has been such a fight for marriage. People still do want to get married, although certainly, you know, Stephanie is right that people also get married later and they like to have all their ducks in a row before getting married, where I think, you know, decades ago it used to be that getting married was one of the ducks you were getting in a row on your way to adulthood. Now it's sort of seen as the final pinnacle. But I also think that there are a lot of people who are saying, you know, this institution is a convention that is just not for me, and we can very happily live our lives as committed partners without that piece of paper. So I think that it's becoming a much more individual decision. On the other hand, you know, it still is the ideal for most people. And that's why there's been such a fight to get marriage legalized across the board.
Gay marriage and all the rest, Stephanie Kuntz, still the goal for most people, despite the fact that not as high a percentage of people are marrying.
I think so. I think the two are connected, that because we have such high expectations of marriage and in combination with that such good options outside it, that people are not willing to settle for a marriage that doesn't look like it'll work, or to stay in a marriage that doesn't seem to be working. And that has its good and bad points. You know, but I think the fact that there is an escape hatch means for many people that they actually have to work harder. But yes, in America, I think most people still see marriage as the highest expression of commitment. There are plenty of people who don't, and as long as they are committed, they do just fine. And when we look at Europe and the Nordic countries, we see that some of their cohabiting relationships last longer than our average marriages. So
it's funny you say people don't want to settle, Stephanie, but then you talk about the most important things in marriage being rather humble, kind of simple, strong but simple things: trust, liking, respect. These are not dazzling things. These are simple, strong things, Stephanie.
But very hard, but sometimes easy to get lost in the first throes of lust and love and excitement and the anxiety that maybe is probably a danger signal, but that we sometimes associate with infatuation. Well, you know, we've been talking a lot about the one-on-one, the one for you, but you know, we all live in the real world. You ought to be proud of who your partner is, and you want to show them off. Like, I think date night is one of the worst pieces of advice that you can give a couple.
Why?
Well, first of all, you know each other, especially the longer you've been together. You know, I know all of my husband's jokes. He's a very funny guy, but I know his jokes. But if we go out together, you know, it's sort of like, okay.
I've heard that joke. So what? So socialize, go out in the crowd.
If we go out with other people, I can show off those same jokes. And then he gets the fun of being respected for how funny he is, and I get the reflected glory of having a mate who's very funny.
Pretty good advice. Pretty good advice. I've just got another second here. Ellen, give us your best piece. 4 years reporting. Now you've got some years into your marriage as well. A baby and another on the way. Advice for those people setting out maybe for a marriage in June coming right up.
Yeah, you know, the one of my favorite lessons from the book, I asked every couple, what is it about this person that made you know this was the one you wanted to spend your life with? And people never guessed the answer, but one word came up again and again and again in every interview, and the word was comfortable. Find somebody with whom you are fully yourself and fully comfortable, and you can really let it all hang out. I think if you can find that, you're well on your way.
Ellen, I'm very glad you went out, did all this reporting, and brought this story back. It's a lot of fun, and it's got a good heart, this book. It's called The Real Thing, Lessons on Love and Life from a Wedding Reporter's Notebook. Ellen McCarthy in Washington, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you, Tom. It's been such a pleasure.
And Stephanie Kuntz in Olympia, Washington at Evergreen State College. Stephanie, thank you for joining us.
My pleasure.
In a moment, the life of blues legend B.B. King. This is On Point.
everybody wanna know. Yeah, they wanna know why I'm singing the blues.
American singer, songwriter, guitarist, bluesman, B.B. Blues Boy King died yesterday in Las Vegas. The King of the Blues, ambassador of the blues. Born to a sharecropper family in Mississippi, grew up in cotton fields, played on street corners in Memphis, and then around the world. He brought the blues to the mainstream with hits like The Thrill Is Gone and Lucille. He's one of the most influential blues guitarists of all time, gone yesterday at 89. With us now from Charlottesville, Virginia, is blues historian Preston Lauterbach. Preston, welcome back to On Point. Wonderful to have you here.
Well, thank you for having me, Tom. I'm not worthy, but I don't know who is.
Well, we'll make you worthy for the day. B.B. King, it's a name so big, it almost doesn't seem real, and yet his beginnings were about as real as it gets, Preston. I mean, we've heard him talk about picking cotton, chopping cotton. He was 14 years old, I think, when his mom and dad were both gone. He was on his own. This was a no-joke, up-from-hard-scrabble roots childhood.
Well, you go down there today where B.B. is from and stand in the middle of those cotton fields, you see nothing from horizon to horizon to horizon, all the way around you, no apparent way out. But through, you know, the sheer force of his talent and tenacity and vision, he was able to get further from his upbringing than virtually anybody else who's been around these days. And so for that reason, I think that his life is one of the great American lives, period, that should be celebrated.
Well, certainly further in miles. I mean, he traveled the world. He performed all over the world. What about musically, the path that he took? What made B.B. King the guy who took the blues into the mainstream, who brought it to so many millions? What was it about the way he presented the blues?
Well, I'll tell you what it was. He was a real hardcore music nerd. Not many people are aware of this. He had a massive record collection that went all the way back to the 1920s, some of the earliest recorded blues. He had a real sense of history. Later on, you know, when he was touring the globe and playing in Russia and China and Africa, he would always dig for records. So he had a real collector and historian attitude about him. But he was a great listener, a gifted performer, and one of those rare personalities whose charisma came through his music. So he really distilled, you know, all of that history and all of that music, but with this unique personality that everybody really related to. So that's really what I think was so broadly appealing about him.
Lucille, he always called his guitar, and what that meant, of the sort of deep affectionate relationship. I've read that it goes back to a story of love and loss and a lady named Lucille, and B.B. carrying that moniker for his guitar all the rest of his life.
Well, he named that guitar after an incident that took place in a roadhouse in Twist, Arkansas. He was performing in a little juke joint, you know, probably not unlike the sharecropper cabin that he was born into. And this would have taken place in the early 50s when he was a broadcaster. You know, he'd get on the air from WDIA in Memphis and say, well, come out to the dance in Twist tonight. Mm. So he was performing for this little juke joint when a fight broke out. And, you know, these were real humble venues. This particular one was heated by an oil drum or some kind of a crude stove. And in this fight, the stove got knocked over, and the shack was in flames. So everybody, you know, in a panic, got outside of it, and thankfully they did. But everybody's standing in the yard of this juke joint while it's burning down, and B.B. realizes, uh-oh, I left my guitar in there. So what does he do? He runs into this burning building, grabs his guitar, and runs back out to safety, later learning that the fight that caused all of this commotion was over a woman named Lucille. And so he gave that name to his guitar in order to remind himself not to act too foolishly.
Remind us of the 1960s and how the blues, B.B. King's not least, got embraced by the rock and roll world, and B.B. King started to get big crowds of people who were not juke joint habitués.
You got that right. It was really the British invasion. Groups like the Stones, the Beatles, Eric Clapton, who was later a collaborator with Mr. King, they all came to America touting all of these stars like, well, stars in black America like Howlin' Wolf, Muddy Waters, and B.B. King, people who were icons in Black America, but due to a segregated world and segregated culture, were little known in white America. So all of these English stars came over here touting people like this, and it really introduced Mr. King to a wider and wider audience, and just in time, because his rhythm and blues popularity had begun to fade, he really had a great run through his Chitlin Circuit years in the 1950s and 60s of R&B hits.
He was happy to move on beyond that, though. Here he was in 1968, paying the cost to be the boss, B.B. King.
As long as I'm paying the bill, woman, I'm paying the cost to be the boss. I'll drink if I wanna, and play a little poker too. Don't you say nothing to me, as long as I'm taking care of you. As long as I'm working
15 Grammys, every Hall of Fame, rock and roll and blues, and he toured and toured and toured very deep into his life. What about his attitude toward the crowds, toward the music, toward the art as he aged, Preston?
Well, I'll tell you one thing, that one way that I got to experience Mr. King up close and personal, which told me a lot about the type of man he was. Yes, he did cross over to this larger audience. It was a great boon to his career and to his life. But he never forgot, you know, these little cotton field shacks that he came from. And so no matter how busy his touring schedule was, how many high dollar demands there were for his talents across the world, every summer he came back to play Club Ebony, a beautiful little nightclub in downtown Indianola, Mississippi, which was really his first home base. And this is a little club I would estimate at the high end would accommodate 500 people. So this is like seeing the Beatles play at a Liverpool coffee house or something after they broke. But he always came back to play Club Ebony because he never forgot where he came from.
I love that. You wonder how an artist keeps it real. You bring it home to Club Ebony every year. That only happens when you're as big as B.B. King, if you really want it to happen. The songs we know so well, you think they were carved in stone, but they came out of many of his experiences. His second marriage to Sue Hall lasted 8 years, ended in divorce in 1966. 1969, the thrill is gone. Here he was playing, singing from his own experience, Preston. That was not just hypothetical, Preston Lauterbach. That was B.B.'s life.
That's the blues. Comes from that experience, and he had it.
Preston Lauterbach, author of Chitlin Circuit and the Road to Rock and Roll and Beale Street Dynasty. Thanks so much for being with us, Preston.
Pleasure's mine.
The thrill is gone. B.B. King is gone. As of today, we salute him. Thanks for joining us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR.